This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Fantastic to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Your chance to catch up on the best bits. Of course, maybe you've missed a bit and you want to hear it again. We are here for you. Looking at children's health, education and parenting on this show. And it was our paediatric clinic with Dr. Shola from MediClinic Middle East. She was on hand answering your question about development. What impact has the pandemic had on everyone from tots to teens? And she was taking your questions too. Looking at traffic rules in school zones, there has unfortunately been a spate of accidents and incidents around the UAE schools. So what can be changed? Is it a simple case of attitude of individuals, or could there be bigger implications for schools or even authorities? We spoke to you, the parents. We spoke to Thomas Edelman from Road Safety UAE and the founder of a new app who thinks technology could be the answer. Plus, inclusion in schools. If your child has additional needs, how did you choose the school and what are the challenges that you as a parent and them as a student have faced during the course of the pandemic? Catherine O'Farrell was on hand. She is the leader of Education Board and she also has a forum for inclusion practitioners. They've been sharing the challenges that they have been facing. And if your kid is year 12, year 13, maybe they're looking to go into a STEM subject, well, one UAE university might just give them a helping hand and for free. Maths tuition for all. Here's all you need to know and more. We are
family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Do we respect traffic rules in school zones? That's the question we're asking this hour. I've been receiving messages into the show on my personal social media about how some parents at their school disregard rules completely. That could be to do with speed, giving way, respecting staff, being rude to those people directing traffic in the school parking lot and on the roads outside. We've seen a memo sent out by a school to parents naming incidents involving other parents shouting at those directing traffic and even running over the foot of a security staff member. Here is Dubai mum Adele. She has a 7-year-old son.
I see cars within inches of children, and sometimes their parents are oblivious to the fact that if that driver accidentally puts their foot on the wrong pedal, that child's life, it's at stake. And we know this. My son went to school with a beautiful young girl and she lost her life 1.5 years ago now because of one lady's fatal mistake in a car park. And this can happen again. We all need to pull together and drive safely and be aware of what is happening around us and report. The buck stops with us as individuals and our approach to the road and driving safely.
Thank you for that, Adele. Let us know your thoughts on this. And Taryn Patel's joining us on the line now. She's a teacher and a parent in Dubai. And Taryn, you've witnessed some pretty unpleasant incidents. Thank you for your time today. So as a parent during the pickup, what are some of the common issues, occurrences that you've seen in and around the school parking lot?
So, hi, Helen.
Hi.
Great to be on your show. So as a parent, I've seen various things. So thankfully, my son's school this year has a really great system in which the parents have to, they've got a name on it and each car pulls up. It's like a grab and go, get your child and run. But as a teacher, things that I've seen previously before I had my own kids is I've seen two fathers almost get into a fist fight where security had to come in and come and separate them from an incident, not where I currently am, but in a previous school that I worked in another country, thankfully. And we've obviously seen some mothers really bad mouth each other as some of their hot tempers get, especially in these hot weather. I think that's one of our big things is, when it's so hot here, all we want to do is just grab our kids and go. We don't want to be walking around in the heat. We want to do it as fast as possible. And tempers definitely flare with the weather.
It definitely is a contributing factor. And, there's no getting away from it. No one is at their best at 7:15 in the morning. You might not have had your first coffee. The weather now, I really do feel for people that are going straight to work in their work gear right now. I've seen some pretty see-through work shirts in the last few weeks. No one's at their best. I think it becomes a simple matter of, you know, do unto others as you want to do unto yourselves. And that's not just other parents, but also those directing traffic. I've seen this, you know, people just simply ignoring these men and women who are outside trying to keep that flow of traffic going. And the speeds at which cars are travelling, as soon as they've done a drop off, it's like, bam, right, I'm out of here, done my bit, without thinking about, you know, children, as you say, walking towards that school or those trying to navigate it. Can I ask you, from a teacher's point of view, what happens if there is a report of a parent flouting the rules or showing blatant disregard for traffic enforcers? What's the process like, Taryn?
Unfortunately, there isn't a huge amount of support from, for us as the teachers or the security. You know, we can speak and we can say, but people kind of see like, oh, well, it's just the... You know, it's just a car guard. It's just a security guard. You go and approach the families or the drivers, and they just kind of, they hear you, and then they just disregard what you said and keep on driving. So it almost seems like there isn't a respect for anyone that's controlling the traffic here. And you know, I look at the guys that work and outside our school gates, and especially like I was saying earlier, in the summer months, which is a good part of our school year, they come in drenched after trying their best and, you know, not getting the respect that they really deserve for trying to keep all these children safe every day.
I have to say our school is pretty calm. I hear about others and it's absolutely horrendous. We have people parking, being lazy and parking where they shouldn't, so families are forced to walk on the road or there's not enough space on the pavement. But I've seen our school principal come out himself, and I think even his presence at that drop-off is there going, right, there he is, he's watching things, he's aware of things, and no one wants to get in trouble with the principal, whether they're a student or a parent. And I think having a member of staff out there, it's going above and beyond their teaching responsibilities, of course, but hopefully it is just enforcing to the security staff, like, we've got your back, like, you know, we are a team on this. What would you like to see change? What do you think needs to change, Taryn?
I think one of the biggest issues that we have is really, I mean, this isn't something that we could see changed at present, but, you know, Zina mentioned earlier when she was doing the traffic that, you know, there's lots of schools and areas, and that's one of our huge problems, is that a lot of schools are built together. In just my area alone, we've got 6 schools around us, so the traffic is crazy, even if it's not just your school. So I think a respect level, I just received my son's KHDA contract, and I was wondering, I haven't had a look at it, but if there's actually something in our KHDA contract that we as parents have to sign to say we are fully responsible for how we drive and how we conduct ourselves in the school parking lot, not just within the school premises. So that's one of the things. And you know, we've been exploring different options in our school of how we can keep our students safe, how we could also make it, because we know that parents have got a lot of parents have got a time crunch, that they do come on their lunch breaks to come and get their children, and they've got to get back to work. How we could make a process as smooth as possible for the parents, and you know, so it's mutually beneficial to everyone. You know, as teachers, we sometimes have parents coming, choosing to come late to avoid the traffic, and then that cuts into our time that we have to prepare for the next day because we still have students within our classrooms.
Taryn, really good to get your perspective as both a parent and a teacher. So thank you so, so much. And I'm sending you Zen vibes for the next the next incident. Stay well, stay safe. Marianne saying the whole system of parking on roundabout zebra crossings is so, so wrong. Should be a staggered system. We had Jim getting in touch. He's a dad and does the school run.
I really think that sometimes the parents might want to retake their driver's education classes and learn a little bit of patience and tolerance in those areas. It's everybody's kids and everybody wants to get home safe with their children.
I think Jim's absolutely right. I think we see this on you know, I don't want to single out Shakeside Road, but we see it on highways as well. People who feel like driving's a game, like it's a competition. You disrespect me, I want to win. And ultimately, we, as he says, we've all got kids, we all want them to be safe, and we've all got places to go. No one's more important than the other. On the text line, no name on this one, saying, our school had to ask police to patrol at pickup time due to the behaviour of some parents. DM from Eamon saying, road rage around pickup is crazy. What are we teaching our kids? Just leave 5 minutes early. An anonymous message saying, I'm always run over every day while walking by speedy parents.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Following a spate of reports and incidents at school run time, that can be, of course, drop off and pick up. We're asking this afternoon, do we respect the traffic rules in school zones? And I want to get your take on this. I've been receiving messages on DM into the show about how some parents simply disregard rules on speeding in school areas, in some cases even being rude to people directing traffic in the school parking lot who are not doing it for the good of their health, people. They're doing it because, one, it's their job, and it's their job to keep our children safe. So please, just spare a thought. A text from a mum in Dubai saying, honestly, almost all schools in Dubai seem to miss the fact that parents with cars will come to pick up their kids at the end of a busy day. Most of them are rushing in between lunch breaks to do that. Parking lots are really poorly designed, and any school is always surrounded by chaos at pickup time because of lack of organisation and the unavailability of places to park. And add to that rude encounters and basic manners. And Charlie's saying, at our school, some parents will park right in the middle of the parking and go inside to pick up their child, blocking three roads and causing chaos. Joined now by Thomas Edelman, the founder of Road Safety UAE. Thomas, great to have you with us. And you did a survey that found that two-thirds of students get transported in private vehicles and 40% of cars just carry one child. There are simply too many cars in school zones at key times.
Yes, absolutely. Good afternoon. I hope you're all right and all safe out there. Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, we always try to elevate the discussion from anecdotal evidence to fact-based evidence. So we did this research. And as you just said, there is a huge dependency on private cars. And this poses all the issues that we have heard before. Now, what about solutions? So how can we tackle that? How can we be creative? And I think one of the ladies that spoke pretty much at the beginning of the show today, she said, hey, let's be creative. Let's talk about solutions. Now, reflecting on that, and today being Father's Day, when my son was young and I dropped him and picked him up at school here, there was one thing, one very simple thing that made our life very easy, both for Oliver, for my son, as well as for myself and for everybody else. And this was time management. You know what I did? Sounds super easy, but I know I arrived before everyone else. So I really tried to make a habit to arrive there very early. And after school, I told Oliver, you know what? Just hang around a little bit with your friends. Just stroll around on the campus. And you know what? I will pick you up 20 minutes after the rush. So it's doable. It's feasible. It's about maybe also working with the school on creative solutions. So, for example, so what can we do with children after school? Yeah, let's give them opportunities. Let's give them room to wait in a safe environment for 30 minutes or whatever. They don't mind to be amongst each other. They like to chat around. They like to be with their friends. And then we can come and pick them up, you know, after the rush, mm-hmm. and in a safe and responsible and more fun way.
I think what that really alludes to is the fact that people are doing this at a really stressed part of their day, either super, super early when they've got a massive to-do list ahead of them. They might not have had their coffee and the kids are probably driving them crazy before 8 a.m. And then, as you say, trying to kind of cram in a pickup maybe during lunch hour when, you know, parking is an absolute premium. So by staggering, spreading it out, I think that would make a huge difference because what we know, we're getting lots of reports of people simply not respecting school zone rules and not respecting the people that are there to enforce them, which is heartbreaking, to be honest. I hate the thought of these men and women being basically shouted at, ignored, put in harm's way because parents think they're more important than them, that their days are more important than their day. And we've got a text from Jazz here saying, I sometimes wish our school parking lot was bigger and there were more zebra crossings around it. I agree. I don't think, however, many people know what a zebra crossing is, judging by the experiences that we're hearing about today. It's not a sign to accelerate. One thing that's outside our school, and I'm curious if you've got any data or any insights on this, is one of those speedometers that's got the happy face and the sad face on. So if you're going, I think, above maybe 30 or 35, it goes red and you get a sad face. If you go below, you get the approval of a robot, which, me being a classic people pleaser, I want to please the robot. I want to get the green light. Do we know if they actually are effective, Thomas?
Yes, for sure, they are effective. So whenever we feel our behavior is monitored, we try just to be better and to improve. This can be Mr. Policeman. This can be the school principal. I love, for example, this one element. And we had the same at the school of my son. The school principal was out there, not every day, but at many days. Yeah, and this is sending a very strong signal. I think another area of improvement is that in schools, typically, there are a lot of smart people. There are smart parents, there are smart children. And it is about, you know, inviting them to come forward with solution proposals, with ideas. We can tap into the creativity of all of these stakeholders. We can talk to the attendants, and we can reward people for good ideas. It is not rocket science. It really boils down to time management, to etiquette, to caring behavior, and to a little bit of creativity.
I think that's absolutely right. You used the phrase stakeholders there, and I'm a firm believer you get out of school what you put in, both in terms of a student, but as a parent as well. And yeah, you can, you know, moan all you like on social media or even on a Facebook group, but unless you're there providing solutions as well as problems, you know, you have got a stake. You're entitled to an opinion. And unfortunately, just by sheer logistics of them working, a lot of the teachers aren't able to be there at drop-off and pick-up because they're in the classrooms. They don't see it. I wanted to leave with this last question from Julio, which I think is a really good one, saying, I find that some schools just give parents a slap on the wrist for flouting parking lot rules. If I see a serious incident, can I report it to the police? What do you think, Thomas?
Yes, absolutely. So if it is about infrastructure developments, and I had a little bit of a pre-chat with Zina on that. So if it is about infrastructure improvement proposals, please reach out to RTA. These guys are super switched on. Invite them to the school to maybe design the flow of traffic better. If there is misbehavior, enforcement always comes down to Dubai police. Again, invite these guys to the school. They're also great presenters. So they have also like an awareness section. So they are presenting at schools. They're presenting at companies. So please reach out to those authorities. This will go a long way.
Thank you, Thomas. Really appreciate it. You can find Thomas Adelman, his research and surveys, plus some great resources over on Road Safety UAE.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Family does matter. And honestly, when you see your life and that of your children flashing before your eyes as someone speeds around the corner after drop-off or pick-up, I tell you what, it makes you, well, one, angry, and two, a little bit despondent about the lack of respect that people seem to have for each other around school areas. Let us know your thoughts on this. What have you witnessed? What have you observed? And what are your suggestions for making it better? 4001 is the SMS. The Air and Play app is there as well. And the phone lines are open, 0487155500. We heard from Adele earlier. She's the mum of a seven-year-old. And she says she's seen her fair share of obscenities happening in school parking lots, and she witnessed this at primary school.
The traffic guards had obviously been given some new directions by the school on how to correctly place the cars so that we could have the maximum amount of cars in the car park. And one particular gentleman parked outside of those guidelines and proceeded to hop out of his car because the traffic guard just, you know, as part of his role, very nicely asked him if he could just simply move his car a few more metres ahead so that a car could stand behind. Now, this particular gentleman, if we can call him that, he didn't like that at all. And he proceeded to verbally abuse the traffic guard at the top of his lungs. And he claimed, I can park wherever I like. I pay for my child to go to this school. I can park my car wherever I like. I'm sorry, this is not how we treat each other. We have a common decency as human beings to speak with one another in a kind way. This gentleman was far from that.
Sounds like a total lack of respect and total lack of social contract. When people are just trying to drop off their kids, people are just trying to do their job. So let us know what you have experienced. And ultimately, if you do have any proposed solutions, one man who thinks he might is Ramsey. He's the head of product at the Arrive app. It's being trialled in some of Dubai schools, hoping to fix traffic school problems. So Ramsey Farkiri, tell us, what have you witnessed that has led you to take some pretty significant action by basically starting an app to tackle this problem?
Hey, Helen.
Hey.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Well, to start with, I too am a parent, and I have been suffering from this pain long before I started specializing in this problem. I do understand our tight schedule as parents. I do understand that the pickup process takes place at a time when we are under the 50 degree of burning sun, and I couldn't agree more. It's a very hectic process. And before I start talking about the solution, I would like to highlight that there's no amount of solutions or technologies that can replace our patients as parents.
Absolutely.
Period.
Absolutely. Just
period.
Common decency and a wish for others to do to you as you do to them. So we talk a lot about Dubai being community and the school community, but when you've got people who are getting into physical fights and abusing each other verbally, that all just seems to fall apart. So you're absolutely right. And an app isn't going to solve everything. It's going to be a tool.
Indeed.
But ultimately, it's going to come down to how we conduct ourselves, even when we're under stress and sweating significantly.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about what do you think the biggest problem is on the school run? When you were looking at identifying a potential solution, was there one core problem you were looking to address?
Yes, well, when we looked at the numbers, we found that schools on average have 180 parents marching in within the same 15-minute time span to collect their kids. And you can imagine the scene and the environment that security officers need to monitor and assure that none of the 180 people are strangers. So given that all the staff is really busy and they all have their specific roles, there's literally no place for misguidelines from parents. And again, if parents don't follow those guidelines, the least that could happen that security officers' attention is diverted. So parents' cooperation sits at the core of children's safety. Now, that being said, the best solution would have been at the time that the school buildings were constructed. Mm. There should have been better planning to encapsulate the corresponding number of vehicles to the student's capacity in drive-in or parking lot.
However,
but it is what it is.
It is what it is. The number one invention.
It's far too late for many schools, yeah.
We would have loved to invent a time machine. In the absence of that, we're looking at an app, Ramsey. So how does the app work and how do you think it's going to address some of the problems that so many people are getting in contact about this afternoon?
So we implement a method called just in time. And what that means is if the parent is able to reach at the same time that the student reaches the designated pickup gate, then we're able to dramatically cut down on serving time. Hence, we can serve a much bigger capacity of parents within that same time period. It's quite simple.
Sorry, I just need you to explain a little bit more about how that would work. Let's role play. So let's say I can't do pickup, actually, as that happens, because I'm always on the radio. But let's pretend I can. I pick up my kids, let's say, at 2:30. And that's I've got a slot between 2:30 and, let's say, 10 to 3 every day. That's my allotted time to go and pick up my two kids from their two classrooms.
Yeah.
How does the app make my life easier? What do I need to have on my phone? And what happens at the other end when it comes to teacher or even the student communicating with me?
Yes. So when you're on your way out to the school, when you're 700 meters away from the school, the app allows you to announce your arrival with a click of a button. And your children's corresponding teacher receives a notification at the other end. And it tells them to send out the student to the exit gate. By the time that you reach to that gate, your child will be waiting for you and ready to be collected. It's that simple.
So it means people aren't going to be in parking spaces for as long as they have been previously. I mean, presumably, especially with the younger ones, my kids are only 4 and 6, there would be an element of a teacher taking them to the collection point or even having them ready at the door of the classroom with their bag on ready because, mum or dad is going to be there in however long it takes me to walk 700. okay, I like the sound of this a lot. What has the school's response been like? Because presumably it requires an awful lot of buy-in from them in terms of staff training, phone access, and all the logistical side, Ramsey.
Yes, so schools buy-in comes number one. And we actually struggle a lot with training. And that's why today we have a very smart training method implemented on the app itself. And we intend to train teachers, security officers, and parents all within 60 seconds of time.
Oh, wow. Okay. We are stressed and short on time, so that does make a difference. A minute of training. We've had a message saying, "What is the app called, Ramsey?"
Arrive.
It's called Arrive. Is it available now from a pure consumer point of view? Obviously, it needs to have the buy-in of the school, but can people go and have a look at it and maybe even take it to their school if they're interested in that institution implementing it?
They can go ahead and tell their schools about it, but they aren't able to access the app unless their school buys in first and adds their information.
Okay, makes sense. All right, brilliant. Thank you so much for your time, Ramsey. Really, really appreciate it. It's great to have some constructive thoughts around this. And of course, it's technology. I love a bit of it. Thank you so, so much, Ramsey. That is Arrive app for anyone who has been in touch asking for this. Let us know how you're feeling about it. Maybe you've just come off the school run now. Your nerves absolutely shattered. And hearing your suggestions as well. Here is Farah. She's a traffic volunteer at her children's school, and she has a suggestion: name placards.
For example, in the drive up when you're coming in to pick up at school, there can be a lot of traffic. And if all of our cars, if we're using private cars, had the surname or the first name along with the class of our child, and as we drove up, the school could announce the name of that child, and the child would make themselves walk forward and enter the car. That way the cars are just kind of passing through the drive up without everybody stopping at once and everybody going in to grab their kids at once and creating a mess.
What are your suggestions? Interesting to get your thoughts on this. Steve's saying about the Arrive app won't work. Schools do not have the infrastructure to support this, safeguarding issues. We've also heard saying the app is a good idea, but what if 180 parents arrive still at the same time? You're absolutely right. The structure still needs to be changed from the school side.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Understandably, lots of messages coming in on this. We've all had negative experiences and we all feel like we might have an answer. So 4001 to join the conversation. Meadows mum saying, touch wood, the last 2 year pickups have been a pleasure. Totally stress-free at our new school. Haven't witnessed a single incident. We have a staggered pickup, so maybe that helps too. Parents actually use indicators and let each other join the flow. Security guys are brilliant always at all schools. Anonymous Master here saying, I'm a teacher. Parents are so inconsiderate. They block spots assigned for us and just leave our car there, which makes me late for work. I have to say, our school is really pretty calm. Apart from a bit of speeding way, I'm, again, like you, Madam, I'm touching wood. Message from an anonymous message on 4001 saying, as an educator, I think we do a great job with the traffic. Our main job is to teach children and safeguard their well-being. If we're not prepared as parents to role model patience, respect and communication with the teachers and buy into learning, then not sure what the answer. It's a two-way street, forgive the pun, and not just a school's issue. You're right, it's a community issue. It's an attitude issue. And joining us on the line now, we have got Andy. Andy, thank you for being with us. You're a dad, an avid cyclist. What have your experiences been?
Interestingly, so I'll draw a comparison to it, that I've got a grown daughter in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they have speed cameras around schools that automatically drop in the morning and the afternoon in terms of the limits that you go, so you can be fined for exceeding the speed around school. So when my son, who's 11, first started at Suffolk Community School 6 years ago, I had an office just around the corner from there. And my frustration levels were so high, you know, in probably the first 3 months of seeing what people did, how inconsiderate they were. I'd already lived in the country this stage 7 years, so it wasn't like this whole thing was new to me. And because I have an events management background, I decided to help the school. I donated a whole lot of cones to the school, identified areas that could be improved, sat down with the owners and the principal. And for the last 5.5 years, you'll pretty much find me outside the front of the school every morning for
Andy,
an hour and a half.
Not all superheroes wear capes. What a legend. Well done, you. Love it.
And the reason why I do this is because of the fact that I can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And sadly, you know, listen, when I speak to people and some people may get offended by it, well, I'm sorry, it's water off a duck's back. I'm here to keep your kids safe. If you have an argument why that's not a great idea, I'm willing to hear it. And I've been fairly fortunate through organising some significant events in Dubai that I have an extensive contact within the authorities here. So I've even reached out to the people that I know. So when I've had difficulty, suddenly they'll send me two or three police cars to help with the situation.
Andy, and what's the response when the backup arrives?
Well, you know, listen, a lot of it's all about planning. Not that they, you know, not that they sit there the whole time, but we, you know, one time we had a policeman that was outside the school for 2 years, and he would come in the morning. But it's also, you know, listen, I'm very firm with people, and I'm give people a warning and everything else. But at the same token, you know, I've had instances where I've had to take photos of cars and send that on to people that I know, because people that are just blocking exits, parking on roundabouts, parking on footpaths, parking on pedestrian crossings. And it's kind of got to the point where, you know, when I'm not around, I have other mums and dads that spy on the whole situation and send me photos because they're equally frustrated. And I don't do this to get people in trouble, but I witnessed a child run over outside of school when I first moved to Dubai. And I was driving past and I witnessed it. It stayed in my mind. And it's like, well, you have to get out there and do this. And I'm sorry, but if people don't like being talked to because of the way that they drive, they talk on their phone, they speed and everything else, well, I'm sorry, I make no apologies, but you'll get a gobful, and I'll tell you why what you're doing is wrong.
Andy, can you please clone yourself and put one at the everyone an Andy clone and a cone at the entrance of every school in the UAE? Andy, thank you so much for sharing your experience, and I think that really comes back to we all have responsibility. Andy there have an extensive experience when it comes to events and having the capability to make changes, but we all have the ability to have some kind of impact with our attitude, I hope. So tomorrow morning, please just try your best. I know I'll be trying to.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your fee-free paediatric clinic. So if you've got any symptoms that just aren't adding up in your little ones, and when I say little ones, I mean from newborns all the way through to teens, maybe something's been on your mind for a while, there's some symptoms that simply aren't adding up, this is your chance to run them past an expert, maybe get a second opinion if you need it as well, of course. Dr. Shola is with us, paediatrician at Mediclinic Middle East, live on Microsoft Teams. How are you, Dr. Shola?
I'm doing very well. And you, Helen?
I'm really well. In total honesty, I'm feeling like COVID's getting a bit close again. I felt like for a long time it was people outside of our friendship groups and outside of where we lived, and the numbers have been pretty consistent over the last couple of months, but it felt a bit abstract until the last week or so when a number of friends have had kids with it, and it's making me a bit anxious again. Yeah, it is, to be honest. Can I ask you what's coming into clinic when it comes to kids and COVID?
Well, for me now, actually, most of my practice is fully dedicated to developmental. So most of my cases are mainly developmental. Mm-hmm. But speaking with colleagues, they are seeing more and more children with COVID coming in. But luckily, most of them are not too unwell. So it presents like your normal cough, cold, runny nose, and then you do a COVID test and it comes positive. And more often than not, there's an adult in the family that's also tested positive, or an adult they've come in contact with. Mm-hmm. But the good news is, yes, we're getting more kids with COVID, but most of them are not unwell with it, or at least not really unwell.
I think that is the point of difference, to be honest, for a lot of families. As you say, it's that window. We're not an ICU with the three-year-old. We're having probably a very difficult time for 10 days isolating with a three-year-old and welcoming care packages and videos and, you know, iPad app recommendations. But as you say, at least the level of wellness is okay. So if anyone is suffering out there with a little one, we are very much thinking of you. If you do need any advice, of course, we are here. Dr. Shola, as you mentioned, a real expert when it comes to children's development. And, you know, we're not going to know the effects, Dr. Shola, of COVID, of distance learning for years and years down the line, from babies that were born during the lockdown through to teens that haven't been able to socialise, have their education. Have you had any experiences or any cases coming in you think actually this could be a direct impact of the last 18 months?
I'm not sure about direct, but I do think it has played an impact on children's development. And I think it's affected it in a positive way and also in the negative. So the negative is because the children, in particular the younger ones, those that are under three that have spent half of their life in lockdown, haven't had the opportunity to socially interact, to learn how to share and things like that with their peers. But on the other hand, parents are now becoming more in contact with their children because you're working from home and you're learning how to split time with the children with responsibility for online working, which has its own issues attached with it. So I find parents are now noticing more or picking more when their children are struggling academically because they're part of the classroom and seeing what the other children are able to do. Mm-hmm. So they're now beginning to think, why is my child not doing this yet? And for the younger ones, parents are beginning to think, okay, how do I spend more time and actively engage and interact with my under three so that I can help with their development? But there was a study actually that was done in the UK, reported in the BBC, where they looked at or spoke to quite a number of schools in England. And the head teachers reported that children starting school in September are needing more support for their language skills than they did in previous years, which suggests that to an extent, the lockdown has had an impact on children's language skill development. So I think, as you said, you know, we will see a little bit of it, but the bigger picture is going to start coming out years from now for us to be able to see how much of an impact COVID has had on children's development.
Dr. Shola, I wanted to ask you about those real younger years where parents might be thinking about putting their kids into nursery, but right now it feels like a bit of a risk in terms of, you know, terms ending sooner than they perhaps should do, paying out amount of money for perhaps reduced hours even. What are some things that parents could do or, you know, nannies working with those families can do to increase some of the language skills that they might be picking up through nursery that just aren't possible right now?
One of the main things that we've been advocating forever, and we can never say enough, is reading to the children. You're never too young to read to a child. Read as much as possible. Find interesting books, books that have sensory parts in it. So the little books that have a bit of fur that the children can touch, they can feel, and for the babies, they can chew on. Read to them. And then the next, not that it's lesser, is playing with the children. Find an opportunity to sit down with the children and actually play with them, get down to their level. So if we learn or we go back to playing with our kids, that's when children learn the most. And interacting and engaging with them, involving them in day-to-day life, trying to have meals together, taking them on outings together as a family within safety issues, of course, that's the best we can do for our children now.
Dr. Shola, I took the kids for eye tests yesterday and the optometrist said that they should be having 3 hours of screen time a week. And I just about fell off my chair. I was like, a week? And that would be amazing. It's not realistic for us as a household, unfortunately. What would your guidelines be from a medical point of view? Please be a bit more generous.
I do try to be generous because I'm a parent myself and I've had little ones. We do have the recommendations and what we've said about screen time. But we know now with the advent of COVID, lots and lots of kids have to be on the screen. For the younger ones, what I tell parents is, even when they're on the screen, because we know there are educational programs on the screen, don't leave them to it. As much as possible, engage with them with it, interact with them with it. Because the problem with the screen is it gives a lot of information, it gives a lot of teaching material, but it doesn't necessarily ask or expect anything of the child. It doesn't expect eye contact, it doesn't expect facial expression, it doesn't expect the child talking back. So what I've told parents, in particular the ones where their children have red flags for autism or there are some concerns, is in as much as I understand that your child can learn from the screen, the same activity, say, for example, puzzles that your child is able to do using an iPad and they're quite competent in it, try and recreate it in real time. Mm-hmm. So you don't even need to spend that much money. Get a picture and cut it into four pieces and use that as an extension of whatever the child has learned on the screen. If the child is learning numbers, get some Play-Doh and get them in there trying to make numbers with Play-Doh, or using that as an opportunity to teach correspondent counting. So it's not only the screen that we see as the evil, it is the lack of contact or the lack of expectation that the screen does not have with the child. Mm-hmm. So if parents or carers can try and bring that into the real world, then the child will be able to extend their learning.
So less passive and using it as a jumping off point.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your paediatric clinic this afternoon. If you can't get the doctors, you're not sure if your questions, your concerns actually warrant a trip or an appointment, just pick up your phone, send us a message, 4001. It's Dr. Shola with us, paediatrician at Mediclinic Middle East, who is on hand to help. She's an expert when it comes to developmental issues, anything to do with the autism spectrum and perhaps reaching any kind of diagnosis there. Dr. Shola Ashwati's been in touch saying, my 11-year-old son still wets the bed at night. He has no clue he does it, is always in deep sleep. He sometimes wears a night diaper, which does affect his confidence. We've tried waking him up in the middle of the night so he can go to the bathroom, but he's ended up sleepwalking and wasn't able to pee. What is the best solution to this, and why do you think at age 11 it still happens? Thank you so much. Dr. Shola, what do you hear upon hearing that message?
Something that I see a lot in clinic, and something that we can work with and we can help him and he can overcome, is my first thought on it. And to answer the last question first, why does it happen? There's usually a genetic link to it. So when I see kids like this in clinic, the first thing I ask the parents is, which one of you was a bed wetter? Because invariably, there's usually an immediate family member that has a history of bed wetting. But that doesn't mean we ignore it and we leave it. Even if a parent says they were bedwetting till 16, it doesn't mean you leave your child till 16. But at least it gives the parents a bit of comfort to know that, yes, it was a problem. We're not bedwetting anymore. So we know that there's going to be an end to this. Then the next thing I look at is to make sure that we run through and make sure that there's no medical problem that is contributing to this. In most cases, there is nothing, but you need to rule out problems with concentrating their urine, problems with the kidney, and it might warrant doing a urine test and doing an ultrasound to check the kidneys and to make sure the kidneys are concentrating well and to rule out diabetes. So you need to rule out the medical issues. Mm-hmm. Once that's done, the next thing is to look at the lifestyle issues to see if the child is drinking enough during the day, which might seem counterintuitive, but if you're drinking enough during the day, you're able to train your bladder to hold more volume as opposed to drinking too close at bedtime. So we discourage drinking too close at bedtime, but encourage drinking more during the day. Then the next thing I go is to work with the child on how to do exercises to improve the strength of the pelvic diaphragm, the muscles that hold the bladder, so that if those muscles are stronger, the sphincter is stronger, they're likely to be able to hold the urine a bit better. Once we've done that, then the next thing we look at is how do we manage it? And there are two main ways. My preferred way is to use a bed wetting alarm. And the bed wetting alarm is usually better and more successful in children that tend to bed wet often. So you're doing it on a daily basis as opposed to the child is bed wetting once a week. Mm-hmm. Because the theory is the child starts bed wetting, the alarm gets triggered and wakes the child up. Unfortunately, it does wake the family members up, but it wakes the child up. The child goes to the toilet to complete the process, and it then ends up that the child will be able to link a full bladder to either controlling it or getting up. The other way we use is with medication. And the commonest medication we use is a synthetic form of a natural hormone produced by the body that helps the kidney concentrate urine, so the child does not make urine. But the thing about that is you have to be careful. If you're given a medication to stop the child from making urine, you need to make sure that your child is not one of those that sneaks water or will get up at night to drink more water, because then you can run into trouble. And that I usually prefer to use short term. Say the child wants to go for a sleepover or they're going on camp and they want to be dry and it's embarrassing for them. So it's either, or it depends on the age of the child, how much of an immediate response we want, and if we're able to be consistent and use the bedwetting alarm. But overall, there are things we can do and the child does get over it.
Honestly, Dr. Sher, I think what that really speaks to is that a huge number of parents and kids have embarrassment around this, but there are, as you say, there's stages of treatment and management. So if anyone's listening and they've got concerns about, and I think it's very important to make the distinction between day nappy use and night nappy use, between potty training during the day and potty training night. It's a completely different kettle of fish, so to speak. Dr. Sher is with us this afternoon. Ashwati, I really hope that helps you and your son.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Children's health this afternoon, from sniffles to red flags in development. We are here for you. When I say we, I mean Dr. Sher, paediatrician at Mediclinic Middle East. No name on this message, Dr. Sher, but I love it. Please recommend a good multivitamin for 8-year-old boys. The gummies found in the pharmacy all covered in sugar. Thank you. Which is why my kids go, Mummy, can I have another gummy? And I go, yeah, it's got vitamin C on the label. Happy days. What do we as parents need to be aware of when it comes to pharmacy gummies? Is there any harm in a little bit of sugar if they are going to be getting some alleged goodness too?
Good thing you said about the names, because no, I'm not going to be giving any names on air at all. And apart from that, I don't routinely prescribe multivitamins to my patients. I only would give you the specific vitamins you need depending on what the issue is. And unfortunately, that does necessitate a blood test. So if you have any concerns, if you have a child that's a fussy eater, which I do get from time to time, it is worthwhile getting them to have a blood test. And the main things you're looking for there is their iron level. You're looking at the vitamin D level. For some children, it's a good idea to look at the vitamin B12 level as well. If there is a deficiency in any of this, then it's more appropriate to give the particular vitamin, because the dose of this particular one in a multivitamin it's not enough. It's not what you need. And if the child is eating well, whatever you get from a multivitamin, they should get from food. So my caution is, rather than just giving a multivitamin, because there are lots of things that are tiny, it makes no difference. Sugar, as much as possible, cut out where you can cut out sugar. And there's some gummies that you can actually see that, you know, it's a gummy that is sweet, but then it's dipped in a sugar coating and you can actually see the sugar coating. I wouldn't be recommending that. If not, your dentist is going to be your best friend. So honestly, we advise, check what they need. If they do need specific vitamins like iron, or vitamin D, which we do prescribe at a higher dose than what you'd ever get in a multivitamin, that would be the best way to go around it.
Thank you, Dr. Sher. A question here and no name on it. And in honesty, you can absolutely get in touch and not include your name. It's more than fine. We just make sure you get the answers that you need. Matt is here saying, when should I worry about my daughter's speech? 5-year-old still struggles with the R and the L sound, R and L, and she does suck her thumb. Thank you.
Okay. Articulation difficulties, it's quite common in children. So as they get older, they get better at pronouncing specific letters. And if you're still worried, if your child's 5, off the top of my head, disclaimer, I'm not a speech therapist, but I think there are problems. It's still allowed up to about age 6. But if you're worried at all about your child's language at anytime, it is worthwhile speaking to a speech therapist and getting a proper standardized assessment. because there is an assessment that looks at language and there is one that looks at speech and articulation. And they'll be able to concretely tell you, okay, this is fine because your child is still within the age where we allow them to mispronounce some letters. Or they'll tell you, okay, they should have been on top of this, mm-hmm. and give you strategies and therapy and how to help them overcome it.
It can sound so cute. My 4-year-old has problems with Luz. And like, you know, when she's saying, I love Lego, I love Wego. I'm like, oh, never change. It's just too cute. A message here from Rusty for you, Dr. Scholl, saying, my 8-year-old complains he can't hear us properly, even when we're speaking right in front of him. His pediatrician says he couldn't pick up any issues, but he didn't used to complain about his hearing. It happened in the last year. Should we see an ENT?
The answer to that would be a yes. But not only to see the ENT, because the ENT would do some testing to check to see if the eardrum is responding as well, if there's fluid in the middle ear. But you do need to get a hearing test for him. Because if someone, a child, a parent, or anyone is complaining about vision or hearing, no matter what my thoughts are or what you think, it is worthwhile making sure you've checked it right. Because there might be some problem that is not easily picked in the clinic room by the pediatrician, mm-hmm. but will be picked up by an audiologist that does a proper hearing test. Okay. And most of these difficulties are things that are amenable to therapy.
Okay, hope that helps.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your paediatric clinic this afternoon with Dr. Scholl from Mediclinic Middle East. 20 years of experience in paediatrics, with the last 15 years focused mainly on developmental and behavioural paediatrics. So send your questions in now. Dr. Scholl, a message here, and we did just mention dentists there, but I'm not sure if you can help or if it is a dental question. But Andrea's been in touch saying, my son is 11 months old and his teeth are light grey. Before I take him to the dentist, do you know what could be causing it? A friend suggested it could be a nutrient deficiency. He's on formula and generally doesn't like sweet things. Thank you. Light grey teeth in a little one. What springs to mind?
The commonest cause of teeth staining that I see are children that are on iron supplements. So just if your child's on iron supplements, it's not unusual for there to be staining on the teeth. And over time, once the iron supplement stopped and completed, it does clear up. If that's not the case, then it could be a problem with the enamel. So that's the layers of the teeth itself. And I'm afraid that's going to be your dentist's question.
Okay, that's fine. That's useful indeed. And anonymous message here. And we always say if we are talking about personal or private things, whether that's financial, family or health in this case, you can, of course, be totally anonymous. Just say anonymous, make up a name. It really doesn't matter. So no name asking here on 4001. My daughter is 9 and has got her period. Is this normal? It doesn't run in our family this early. I got mine when I was 14 and so did all my sisters. And I'm freaking out. 9? I don't like the phrase normal very much, especially when it comes to health, Dr. Scholl. But is there a range that you would consider to be somewhat normal when it comes to that first period?
The average age for girls is around 11. But as mom said, it does tend to depend on when your mom started or your aunties and things like that. But the range for typical puberty is anything from 8 up to age 14. So in theory, for a 9-year-old, it's still within what would consider as acceptable. But if mom's convinced that this is totally atypical from the family, because if most females in the family did not start puberty or start their period till 14, then this is very early for this little girl. Again, check on that side. Are there any other female members of the family that started puberty early? If that's not the case, then it might be a good idea just to do some blood tests and to make sure that everything is going okay.
All right, thank you, Dr. Scholl. A text from Magna here saying, my 3-year-old was sent home from nursery last week because of fever and vomiting. He tested negative for strep and COVID and his fever went away after a day. Doctor said it was probably a tummy bug. Any idea what kind? Thank you. And I think that does kind of speak to the point that as soon as a child is sick at the moment, we're going, COVID, it's got to be COVID, COVID test. And of course, we should be testing for COVID for obvious reasons. But there's still an awful lot of nasties going around right now. What are you hearing and seeing?
There's so many. It could be anything from rotavirus. It could be any of the viruses. And it could even be a bit of food poisoning. It could be anything, really. But from the history, the most likely is it's going to be a virus. Because viruses that happen, it's acute, and the children recover from it quickly. Vomiting and fever could even be pneumonia. It could be anything. So honestly, the best thing is if the fever doesn't settle, the vomiting doesn't settle, then you need to get the child checked out properly.
Okay. Really hope that helps. I hope little one is feeling better. Abed's been in touch saying, what is a natural and effective way of getting a child to release phlegm? Don't like using Ambroxol or other drugs. Thank you. I don't know if we've spoken about this before, Dr. Schiller, but when I had my first baby, I was given a gadget that attaches to your vacuum cleaner that you stick up the baby's nose, sounded drastic, pretty effective. Yeah. So natural ways of getting a child to release phlegm. And often they don't know how to blow their nose. They can't do that up to a certain point. What can be useful from your point of view that you've seen?
The manual suction machine is pretty good. So first of all, start with subsaline solution. Because if you just do either a saline spray or saline drops into the nostril, it helps loosen the mucus and it's not as thick. So the child can either cough it and invariably they're going to swallow it rather than cough it up, or they sneeze and then you get it all over you. That's the easiest way for the child. Now, there are some suctions, like you said, that have a bit more oomph and you attach it to the vacuum cleaner. Well, I have parents that say that works. Or you could just do the one that has a handball that you can use to suction gently. Or there are some that the way it's formed, you attach it and you can suck through it yourself.
But freaks me right out, Dr. Schiller, the thought of sucking. No, thank you. Like, I love my child very, very much, but do I want to be myself removing their snot? No. I remember, it's obviously Father's Day today, internationally. I remember my dad, when I was really little and him not having any tissues, and him saying, just blow your nose into my hand. And me going, even at like 4 or 5, going, Dad, that's disgusting. That is love, is what that is, Dave Spearman. Yeah. That is love. It's good bit of saline solution, I bet. That's what you need. Dr. Schiller, thank you so much for your time today. You can be found at MediClinic Middle East. You are a superstar. We'd love to, and apologies to anyone whose message we couldn't get to this afternoon. We'd love to have you back very, very soon. Hope you and the team are well, stay positive, test negative, and all of that good stuff. But yeah, really appreciate your time this afternoon.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Sunday afternoon, talking education today, and asking you, honestly, upon reflection, whether you are a parent or an educator, how inclusive is the school? How equipped are the inclusion practitioners that the school assigned to look after children with different needs? Catherine O'Farrell is the head for an education group here in the UAE, and she hosts a voluntary forum for inclusion practitioners. She started during COVID as she attempted to troubleshoot with her colleagues about how they could support the most vulnerable during the peak of the pandemic. She's on hand this afternoon to explain a little bit more. Catherine, this is really wonderful work. And, you know, children with special needs were amongst some of the most effective segments of society when lockdown happened in particular. Kids were forced to learn from home virtually. You know, they had their routines, their anchors, the familiar faces taken away from them. It's near far from ideal, children with additional needs. So can you tell us about some of the problems and their parents are faced with even now?
One of the biggest challenges would be just the lack of accessibility, the inability to come on campus. A lot of parents are really struggling with the fear of their kids being infected, and particularly with kids with individual needs and varied needs. And they're just so reluctant to bring the kids on site that there's a huge amount of instructional time being lost. So we're really seeing quite a bit of regression in our kids or students with determination.
And when it comes to that kind of support system as well, you know, as I said, you have host a voluntary forum. What are some of the kind of common complaints and issues that parents are bringing up time and time again?
We're seeing a lot of concerns around kind of social connections and connectivity with peers. a lot of our students are developing really quite complex needs and their well-being is really suffering. We have on the forum, it's a mixture of both inclusion practitioners and counsellors. So our counsellors are really seeing huge increases in concerns around mental health.
You know, you set up this amazing initiative and it is for your fellow practitioners. Can you tell us a little bit about where they get their training to qualify for the job and perhaps some of the challenges that they as practitioners are facing away from even the parents and the children?
Okay, so an inclusion lead would generally be the person in the school who manages special educational needs delivery. So you'd have, like, essentially it's called a SENCO, Special Educational Needs Coordinator. And then you'd have counsellors or social workers. There's kind of a grey area in the interpretation of a counsellor and social worker. So generally your counsellor will be a psychologist who would be seeing the students face-to-face and managing well-being.
Where I feel like I've personally got a bit of a disconnect is because, you know, my children haven't got any in additional needs that we know of, you know, they're still young. And it can feel like quite a separate entity within schools and it can feel quite other. So I know that some of the words and phrases you're using, a lot of parents at home will be nodding along and it sounds like something that they're familiar with, whereas an awful lot of us simply haven't had any access or any information about these departments and these experts. And I feel like that's perhaps one of the issues, that, you know, the rest of the school doesn't know what's happening with some really qualified people and some children that do need, you know, additional care. How do you feel like schools can be integrating more, perhaps?
It depends very much on the school and the ethos that you have from, say, the leadership team. Some schools, unfortunately, yes, they see kids with special needs and they say, right, this is for your department only, and you have a lot of teachers who, because they don't have specialised training, they might be fearful, they simply may not understand the needs, they will kind of shift the kids' responsibility over to the inclusion team. Now, I think that's changing a lot, especially in the UAE, where we're seeing schools are becoming a lot more inclusive, and that's driven by policy, like Dubai particularly, with the new inclusion policies that KHDA have released, there's been really huge advancements. It definitely depends on the school's leadership. That dictates how inclusive a school would be.
And Catherine, in your experience or what you're hearing from fellow practitioners in the field, what are some of the biggest mistakes that schools make in the area of inclusion?
Kind of seeing it as a separate entity. Like, the number one person responsible for any student in a school is the class teacher. And they have to be fully informed about the different needs that they're facing. And that's down to the school's team. The inclusion team should be in their classrooms, in with the teachers, showing them this is what, say, for example, what dyslexia looks like. This is what ADHD looks like. This is what you can do to support us. Because teachers, we can't expect them to be experts on everything. You know, it is a specialised training. So we have to support them and show them how to handle all the different needs that they're facing. It's a huge gambit, and we've got kids becoming more inclusive as a country. We've got kids with really some profound needs sitting in mainstream classes. So it's challenging for teachers. It really is.
And what about the identification of particular issues as well? Where do you think we are with that?
Hugely under-identifying in the UAE, for sure. Now that we've had kids distance learning so much, identification has dropped hugely. Kind of bespoke or not anecdotal evidence that I'm gathering from people around, we're looking at probably about a 30% drop in identification for over the past year, simply because teachers aren't seeing a lot of the kids face to face. You're dealing only online platforms, so you miss some of those nuances that you would get if the kids were in front of you.
I hadn't even thought about that. And that hadn't even occurred to me, but you're absolutely right. And as parents, we know our kids and we know their quirks, their behaviours, their norms, what works them, what, you know, what resonates and what doesn't. And a big plus of distance learning has been parents becoming more engaged in their children and what they're learning at school. But as you say, it hadn't even occurred to me that the role that teachers play, because, you know, they've got years of experience of understanding development and the academic side, the social side. And while we might look at our, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 year old and go, oh, that's just the way he or she is, a teacher will be able to draw really useful parallels, especially if it's a firstborn child. As a parent, you know, we're kind of, you know, feeling around in the dark a little bit. And there's a lot of parental instinct, but that education instinct must be really crucial. So a drop of 30% in the last year in terms of identifying, that is significant.
It really is. And if we're not catching it in schools, then, as you say, like parents, they don't really have those yardsticks to check the norms against. Mm. It's really easy to miss things.
When you say things, what kind of diagnoses are you talking about, Catherine?
Everything, every kind of need. Like a teacher will spot things like ADHD that, say, a parent might interpret as being energetic, where there could be an actual need there. Something like dysgraphia, dyscalculia, all of the things that you might not pick up as a parent because you don't have comparisons for them. Mm-hmm. And if they're not picked up and they continue, the child's well-being will suffer, they won't be able to perform, and they simply won't have the support they need.
And I think even aside from the academics, which of course is crucial in school, but there's also the social side. It's also, getting on well with their peers and, you know, communication skills. And the last thing you want is a child to be ostracised and not fully understood. And that, as you say, that it doesn't actually need to be a formal diagnosis, but certainly investigation of something that could be problematic in the future is so important to be getting it early, because we know in terms of treatment, whatever that looks like, whether it's medication or talk therapy or play therapy or you know, depending on the needs of the child, the earlier the better.
Absolutely.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Helen with you, and we're talking education. Catherine O'Farrell is head of an education group. She also hosts a voluntary forum for inclusion practitioners. She started it during COVID as she attempted to troubleshoot with her colleagues about how they could support the most vulnerable during the peak of the pandemic. So what are some of the questions that parents should be asking, Catherine, in terms of their inclusion policies when they're looking at a new school?
I would be checking the website. Like it may seem window dressing sometimes, but you can really pick up a school's ethos from what they've got on their website. Like if they've got really inclusive activities happening, if they've got pictures of varied needs on their website, you can tell that it'll give you an indicator. When you're talking to principals, talking to senior leaders, whoever's walking you around the school on the initial tour, listen to their language and listen to the way they speak about the students. And are they talking about varied needs? Do they mention it? It shouldn't be focused solely on academic performance. It should be the holistic view of the child. How do we support the child holistically? You can see as well if they have special programs. Like here at Bloom, we've just rolled out a program with the Special Olympics, where it's a program called the Unified Champion Schools, building inclusivity into the school with this special program. So if you see things like that, it'll indicate to you if the school is inclusive.
I'm sure lots of parents have had really difficult situations when it comes to not feeling included with their child, you know, not being integrated fully. And I think that in itself is reason enough to change schools. There must be an awful lot of support around, you know, whether that is through Facebook groups or WhatsApp groups, parents that are sharing their own experiences.
Absolutely. There are so many initiatives going on at the moment in the UAE. Like, there are really amazing groups. I know you know Heroes of Hope. You've spoken with Holly before, I think, haven't you?
Yes, that's right.
So Holly has got a huge impact on the community. There's lots going on in terms of those kind of groups aimed specifically at kids with individual needs, and they're all voluntary, they're all free, just like the forum. Everything is free and open, and people can come and access all sorts of information from all sorts of people, not just parents but practitioners, inclusion leads, school leaders. There are loads of places you can go.
And, you know, just to take a moment for the educators and, as you say, the heads of inclusion, what are some of the challenges facing them?
Ensuring that your leadership team fully back you up, that's probably one of the biggest challenges. To be inclusive, as I was saying, you have to get the teachers on board. They're your number one, your bread and butter, if you will. If your senior leadership team don't fully back you and fully integrate your department across the school, that's probably the biggest challenge.
And what would you say to any parent who is recognising signs in their child that you know, they feel like need a further investigation, but they're almost reluctant to do that, whether that's stigma attached to mental illness or because they're afraid of what a diagnosis might mean for their child?
It's a valid fear. It's a huge challenge here in this region. Parents are really reluctant to investigate, and you very often see kids, they'll get to the senior grades and they will never have had their formal diagnosis. And it can be detrimental. But it's a real concern, and it's fully understandable that parents would be. But my advice would be, don't be afraid and take action, early action. The earlier the better. Because the vast majority of special needs or individual needs can be managed and can be supported to a point where a child can function absolutely fine.
And, you know, there's an awful lot in the press right now about adults having a diagnosis of ADHD, of dyslexia, in their 30s, 40s and even older. The change, they say, in having a label, and labelling can sound really negative, but sometimes it can be something really positive, because it does give you an identity and give you answers, and it can give you a plan. And for parents of you know, as you say, who might be concerned about that, you think about your child, you know, decades down the line, where they haven't felt like things make sense, or they felt other or outside, only to have a diagnosis as an adult and for everything to click into place. And it sounds incredibly joyful for a lot of these adults who feel like they've finally got the answers. But how frustrating, how difficult, how traumatic for a child to be going through education system feeling like they're not being understood by their teachers or by their peers, or they're being heard by their parents.
And it's not knowing why you're struggling to do something that your friends around you don't struggle to do, that can be detrimental. It's really detrimental. There are some connotations around labelling, yes, but as you said, it helps you understand what barriers you have.
And what opportunities you have as well, and understand who's there to help you. You know, I've been in the UAE 14 years now, and thinking about the language used, the assistance out there, how much more mainstream, and of course there's always going to be more to do, how much that has changed in terms of accessibility, even affordability, and it being worked into things like health insurance or in schools as well. What would you like to see in the future, Catherine? You know, if we look ahead to the next 5 to 10 years in schools, what if you could wave a magic wand when it comes to inclusion in our education system? What would you like to see?
I think celebration of needs. Like, there's a huge stigma associated with certain needs, where, just as I said, understanding the barriers, and you said understanding the opportunities. That's probably what I would do. Help people celebrate difference rather than sweep it under the carpet. Because things like, for example, dyslexia, you could be a really, really good strategic thinker because you have dyslexia, as opposed to if you didn't have it, you wouldn't have had to develop those skills. So that exactly like you say, celebrate the opportunities and bring them to the fore.
Talking education there with Catherine O'Farrell, head of an education group, who's on a mission to include and improve the experiences of children with additional needs and their parents too, especially during the pandemic.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Continuing our chat around education this afternoon, and asking if your child is in years 12 and 13 and looking to go into anything STEM-based, perhaps some free math tuition wouldn't go amiss. Well, that's exactly what one university here in the UAE is offering. Speaking to us now, we've got Dr. Mohammed Azali. He's a lecturer in mechanical engineering at the University of Birmingham here in Dubai, joining us to tell us more. I've got to be honest, Dr. Mohammed, the thought of math tuition sounds like a punishment to me, but for many, this is an amazing opportunity. It takes me back. It really, really does. And I really feel for this age group. I mean, I feel for all students, to be honest, who've been faced with some really challenging circumstances during the course of the pandemic. But that transition from high school to university is one that really I don't think we can underestimate. So tell us a little bit about why you feel extra online tuition support and free can really benefit this age group.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. It's been a very challenging 18 months. I'd like to add it's been challenging for everyone, so not only students. We, as one of the top universities, we feel that we have a responsibility towards students. And that's really any student, like you said, who's in the final 2 years of their studies. And we just want to help. So math tends to be a very good predictor of well-being, welfare, success, financial in life. We need to help them in that transition because it's not been easy.
So this is mathematics students who are keen to continue into higher education from September. So you're saying math can be a good indicator of kind of future so-called success, because people measure success differently. But when it comes to earnings, even, why do you think it's such a key marker?
So basically, when we look at the learning outcomes of mathematics, we tend to get stuck at some mathematical notions. So if I tell you at A levels we'll do integration, you'd think that if I teach you how to solve an integral, you'd be only learning how to solve an integral. But the reality is, if you're solving mathematics, you have to think. You have to acquire some skills which include critical thinking, logical reasoning, time management, decision making, etc., etc. So when you're learning to solve a complicated problem, you're actually using your brains, which is a good thing because the brain is a muscle. And the more you use it, the more it grows and the smarter and stronger it becomes.
We should be clear, this isn't just about getting kids into the University of Birmingham. This is a kind of impartial support, really. How does it actually work in terms of students or parents perhaps applying and getting some extra help?
Yeah, so absolutely. And this is why we need to put emphasis on the fact that it's absolutely for everyone. This is why the brief is so short, if I may say, like any year 12, 13 student, that's assuming they're at A-level, so any student in the last 2 years of their studies. And it doesn't matter if they want to join us or not. All what matters is that they're looking for help. We are willing to provide help. That's it, basically.
And what does it look like in terms of the actual support, the actual tuition, Dr. Mohammed? Can you explain a little bit more about the logistics?
So we have a couple of courses, right, that were developed at the University of Birmingham. They are very, very high quality courses. And we'll make them available to any students who want to get access to them. And it could be a student, it could be a group of students, or it could be a school. So tomorrow morning, I have a meeting with a school who wants to get access to the courses, for example. And the idea is very simple. We have all of the videos, but I do acknowledge that the videos may not be enough. Some students may need additional support. And what we are proposing is that if a student needs additional support to, let's say, plan and, you know, have a schedule and decide which videos they need to watch, what they need to do, etc., etc., I'm willing to help. But also if they need additional one-to-one math support, we're also willing to help. So again, the key word, I guess, is flexibility, adaptation. We're just trying to help. And, you know, however that help may look like, we'll make it happen.
Glad I've got you on today, because I'm hoping that this is going to be encouraging for young women as well as young men. And I'm curious what your split is like when it comes to boys and girls, I guess, on some of the STEM courses at the University of Birmingham. What is that split like? Can you explain a little bit more?
So there's absolutely no science behind this whole boy/girl difference, in the same way that there is no science to back up anyone who says, I'm not good at math. Science says we are good at what we practice. And the more you practice something, and there's plenty of studies, and when I say studies, I don't mean theoretical studies, like studies that have followed like 60,000 students, for example. What matters is ultimately how hard you are willing to work. There's some, you know, percentage differences in starting points if someone has a little bit more talent, you know, for lack of a better word, but the only predictor of if you make it or not is if you believe that you can learn anything that you want to learn. This comes back to the idea that the brain is a muscle, basically. I'm currently teaching computer science and mechanical engineering program. We tend to see, I'd say, a little bit more boys than girls, but the numbers aren't like very far apart.
That's hugely encouraging. And in terms of students who are looking at going into mechanical engineering, for example, but indeed anything that might require some extra maths, what are some of the careers that could be available to them? And crucially, could those careers be replaced by a robot in 10 years' time? How future-proof are they?
So I think what I keep telling my students all the time is that historically we failed to predict the next big thing, right? The students who are joining us next year or joining any university next year are, what, 18 years old now? So they'll graduate, they'll like go to retirement by the year 260 to 70. So basically it's very hard to predict the skills that will be needed. The only thing we can predict is that to continue being successful, you have to keep learning. So adapting a mentality which encourages perpetual learning, learning all the time, and growth mindset, having this attitude that says, I can learn this even if I, you know, I think I'm bad at it, or I think I need to put a lot of effort to do it. That's the only thing that matters.
It's so true. And because we're living longer, as you say, you know, they could be working until their 70s or 80s, because at that, you know, in 2060, 2070, people could be incredibly healthy later in life and wanting to work and being capable of it, and perhaps, of course, financially needing to as well.
Absolutely. And if I come back to your question on robots, even if you are to replace a certain type of jobs with robots, someone has to make those robots, someone has to do the programming for the robots, etc., etc. So whatever job we lose, we must be, you know, creating new jobs to replace it with. To be able to create new jobs and to be able to be successful at those new jobs, you need to have this mentality of saying, I can learn this new skill.
When it comes to starting with the university in September, what is that going to actually look like?
Ideally, would like to be 100% on campus, but it's very hard to predict. Even in the UAE, we have to prioritize health and safety.
Dr. Mohamed Zalideh, lecturer in mechanical engineering at the University of Birmingham here in Dubai. You can be good at maths and anything else. Just need to put in the work and practice.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.